hands up there.
I know there's a microphone here, but I'm an old-fashioned sort of girl, and I tend to trust my own, the power of my own voice. Right, well, I'd just like to start by thanking Jim Edmondson and all of the team at the Dittrich Museum for the opportunity to be here tonight. Much of my talk this evening is actually the result of discussions with friends and colleagues in various medical museums internationally, and although the Dittrich Museum is very distant from the London medical museums, we tend to share developments a lot and we tend to discuss things. And on a very personal note, I really value Jim's input into my own work, and it's something I think that Florence Nightingale would be pleased but surprised about, to see the speed with which we all communicate, assuming that the time difference matches up. Especially since I moved to the Florence Nightingale Museum 2 years ago, I've been really preoccupied with the role that personality museums play in working with professional and disciplinary groups. And I think that this is particularly relevant in the field of medical museums. And I think what is particularly interesting is the really strong emotional attachment that such groups have for certain key individuals in history. And as I'm going to prove, I hope, by the end of this talk, there's no other character in history that such a strong emotional attachment is evidence than that of Florence Nightingale. So what I'm going to do this evening is begin by examining the role of the nurse in Victorian Britain, because this gives you an overview to the work that we're carrying out at the Nightingale Museum. We're then going to examine the challenges of how to provide a really sort of balanced historic perspective when working with all of these different groups and the professional audiences and communities. And then last, I'm going to end up by giving a case study as an example of the challenges of managing relationships, because I want to tell you about a big controversy that is raging around me in London St Thomas's Hospital over a proposed statue. And I thought I'd end up with that, because I thought we all enjoy hearing about arguments that don't involve us. So before we begin, I'd just like to tell you something about my own background, my own professional background, because that really does impact on what I'm going to be talking about tonight. So I've worked in a number of different museums, but of those, three, I think, can be described as personality museums. So with apologies to my husband and children, we have on the screen at the moment the most important person in my life. As I mentioned, I've only been at the Nightingale Museum 2 years, so we're very much still in the honeymoon period. There's no problems between us as yet. And my relationship with Nightingale is helping me to heal the scars from being torn away from my first great love, that of Samuel Johnson. So for 10 happy years, I lived, breathed and slept Johnson. And when I say slept, we actually lived in the house with my family. We actually lived in his Georgian townhouse in London's Fleet Street. And he was a huge part of my life. But since leaving Dr. Johnson's house, I've been very firmly in the 19th century. So I've had to completely leave everything Georgian behind me, which is still bearing the scars. So after leaving Dr. Johnson's house, I spent 4 years at UCL Museums and Collections. And one of the collections I managed was that of Francis Galton. Now, of course, initially I thought this eminent Victorian is no substitute at all for the great Johnson. But inevitably, on close connection, close contact with the collection there, and working with all of the researchers and the people involved in this collection, he really began to get under my skin as a really intriguing and controversial figure. And particularly his work on early eugenics is something that causes a lot of problems at University College today. And I was particularly pleased on leaving University College and moving to the Nightingale Museum to discover that they're actually connected. Nightingale and Galton are connected by marriage, their first cousins married each other, and they corresponded. They had a shared love of statistics, and there are actually letters in existence of them writing to each other. So I didn't need to tear myself entirely away from Galton in the same way that I had to from Samuel Johnson. So Galton and I, you know, we're still in touch. Now, Florence Nightingale had announced her ambition to become a nurse to her family at quite a young age, and her family were absolutely horrified. "It was as if I had wanted to be a kitchen maid," she said. And of course, Nightingale's family were wealthy. They were very comfortably off. And she wouldn't have been expected to do anything at all other than marry, you know, nice, respectable, probably slightly older man, or failing that, perhaps stay at home and be a comfort to her parents. Now, I've got no idea what that means, but it sounds pretty grim. And I think Nightingale obviously agreed, because she announced to her parents she had no intention of staying at home. But it was in particular the ambition to be a nurse that caused the problems. And this is why the Nightingales reacted so strongly to their darling daughter voicing their ambition. She eventually prevailed. Incidentally, we have on screen at the moment the earliest known photograph of Nightingale. And this was taken in Germany, and she had just managed to get her own way with her parents, and she was allowed to spend 3 months at the Kaiserswerth Institute for Deaconesses, which is just outside Dusseldorf. And her biographer, Mark Bostridge, claims that in this photograph there's evidence of a slightly smug expression. This is a young woman who's actually managed to get her own way. But she also travelled and inspected hospitals and medical institutions around Europe. So she was really getting a clear overview of medicine at this time. Now, I think to get a clearer understanding of the Nightingale's parents' reaction to her ambitions to become a nurse, we need to look more broadly at the role of the nurse in Victorian Britain. Now, industrialisation in Britain had caused absolutely massive changes in a very, very short period of time. And I feel that we need to start off with a statistic here, because I don't think Nightingale would approve if I got through an entire talk without giving a statistic. For the first half of the 19th century, the British population increased from just under 9 million to just under 18 million. So it quite literally doubled, and the change was also, of course, that people moved into towns instead of being a rural society. Now, this obviously impacted on the social and the health life of society as a whole. Basically, people would have been cared for at home when they were sick. Hospitals would have seemed to have been too risky. They were very dirty and dangerous places. And it's not without reason that Nightingale later said, "The first call on a hospital, the first requirement of a hospital is that it should do the sick no harm." Early 19th century hospitals tended to be very strongly associated with perhaps lunatic asylums or fever hospitals, or places for the very, very poor, workhouses or pest houses. Without question, the biggest figure in pre-reformed nursing is actually a fictional character. It's that of Sarah Gamp, who's the travelling nurse immortalised in Charles Dickens's 1844 Martin Chuzzlewit. And we've got a lovely illustration from this book on the screen at the moment. And Mrs. Gamp is the small, dumpy lady in the middle who's dropping a curtsy. And basically, Mrs. Gamp is a travelling nurse who was based in Holborn in London, right in the centre. And we can tell from the descriptions in the book that she's in effect carrying a sort of rolling database in her head of local residents, because her jobs would have been to act as midwife or to lay out the dead, as she's been doing here, or to watch night watching for fever patients, or watching the mentally deranged. And we can see that, you know, when she's asked to do things, she's clicking away in her head about, you know, when people are due to have this baby and when someone's, you know, someone's likely to die and need her. And it's a fascinating description. She describes herself as a sober creature to be got at 18 pence a day for working people and 3 and 6 for gentlefolks, night watching being an extra charge. So this illustration is the first time we meet her in the book. She's just been to lay out Anthony Chuzzlewit and to wash him down after his death. And she's meeting the new bride of Jonas Chuzzlewit. And here she is giving a slight sort of wink and a bit of a sly nudge. And she's handing over her business card saying, you know, 9 months' time, dearie, you'll be needing me. You give me a call. And basically being very tactless indeed. In the year it was published, the famous magazine, Fraser's Magazine, said, Mrs. Gamp may be a caricature, but her likeness is very traceable. So we have this reinforcement that she's, you know, a not unreasonable character. And it's hard for us to tell whether Dickens created this stereotype of the travelling nurse or whether he simply capitalised on an existing stereotype. But nevertheless, we know from the Nightingale's reactions and from many other sources that this stereotype existed, that the Mrs. Gamps of this world were dirty, they were dishonest, they'd rob you as soon as you were asleep, and they also drank. And Mrs. Gamp in the book is continually asking for a bottle of something to be put on the mantelpiece that I'll just touch to my lips now and then when I feel the need. So these drunken, dirty, nasty women that you are forced to have in your house when you absolutely needed to. It would have been seen to have been disgraceful to send your relative into a hospital because it would basically be an admission that you couldn't care for them at home. And often neighbours would help, particularly by watching at night. So hiring in a nurse, such as Mrs. Gamp, was another option, and it was seen as a cheaper option than getting in a doctor, because a doctor would often prescribe something and you would then have to go away and buy medicine, and they would also be more expensive to start off with. So purely on a cost basis, calling in nurses was more effective. And it wasn't a question of there being some home nurses that went to rich families and some went to poorer families. We can see that these women basically travelled throughout all the different strata of society. And it seems absolutely fascinating that they must have had a window that would have been fairly unique, I think, actually, in Victorian society. The real-life Mrs. Gamp was actually based on a nurse that was employed by Mrs. Burdett Coutts, who is a friend of Dickens, and who was very wealthy. And Dickens met her and was unable to resist putting her in a book, which is typical Dickens. Now, this distrust of having a strange woman in a sick room, I think, goes part of the way to explaining the unease that we've just seen about these women. And I think that we can possibly break down this unease and this distrust into a number of different ways. One is that nurses would be physically intimate. They would have to touch, they would have to move, they would actually literally be touching the bodies of the patient at a time when they were at their most vulnerable. So, obviously, that has an inherent tension. Secondly, as I think we all know, having sickness in the home, particularly if it's serious, is a stressful time. And families do not show themselves to their best advantage at stressful times. And actually having a stranger in the midst as a witness to that again, it's easy to blame the stranger who's watching people snapping at each other and perhaps behaving rather badly. This unease certainly predates Dickens, and we can see from Daniel Defoe's Journal of the Plague Years that was published in 1721. He writes, "Many frightful stories told us of hired nurses who attended infected people, using them barbarously, starving them, smothering them, or by other wicked means hastening their end, deliberately in order to steal from them." So this tension about having a strange woman in a private space, in a personal space that was the bedroom, I think does go quite a long way to perhaps explaining this distrust and this really appalling character that these women had. One of the women who nursed with Nightingale in Scutari, and was one of the very few that that Nightingale wasn't very, very critical about, because Nightingale did have a very sharp tongue, we can see from her references that her previous private patient had criticised her quite heavily. One of her complaints is that she sewed too loudly. Yeah. The lady wrote, "So noisy, it spoke in such a loud tone of voice and made such a noise with her needle and thimble when at work. It was quite annoying. I spoke to her about it, and she said it was quite impossible to help it. A loud click with every stitch, the scratch with her thumb down the seams. Two or three times I found a half-eaten apple left on the table. Walnuts cracked." And I think it's perhaps difficult for us to take too seriously a criticism that the nurse was sewing too loudly. But again, it's this manifestation of this distrust and this unease that we can see. So on the screen at the moment, we've got an Edinburgh infirmary in the mid-18th century. So again, this is obviously, you know, going back in time to the pre-reform era. So hospitals, as we've seen, were justifiably feared as being quite likely that you'd come out worse than you went in. There was little ventilation, so there was cross-infection and strange smells. There was literally no night nursing done at all unless you were literally dying or you were having a baby. Most of the nursing was done by patients themselves who were actually getting better and were able to walk around. Or there were some elderly women who, for the price of their bed and board, would actually do some sort of light nursing in the wards. A hospital nursing would have been much less strenuous than home nursing. And we can see from a census in 1841 that many of the hospital nurses were in their mid-40s or over. There are many women who moved from hospital nursing to home nursing, and there was a lot of overlap. There's a particular Welsh nurse called Elizabeth Davies, and I want you to remember her because she's going to pop up later on in my talk. She's a Welsh nurse who also nursed in Scutari with Nightingale. And she began her medical career in assisting women as a servant, as a domestic servant. And she assisted women who were in childbirth. And from then, she went on to become a hospital nurse and also a home nurse before she went out to Scutari. She did actually argue with Nightingale, and the two of them clashed. She wrote a brilliant autobiography that I do recommend. It makes very, very entertaining. She cites the reason that she took against Nightingale before they'd even met, because she said that she didn't like her name. I didn't like the name Nightingale, and I'm very apt to know if I'm going to like a person before I meet them, just if I like the sound of their name, and I'm always right. So she clashed with Nightingale. Life as a hospital nurse was actually not unlike that of a domestic servant, and like Elizabeth Davies, we can see there was a lot of overlap between the two roles. women would live in. They would be often wearing a uniform of some sort. And sometimes they wouldn't actually be referred to as their own name, but by the role that they undertook. So you would have Sister Accident, for example. And I think there must have been a tension between the home nurses and doctors, because nurses were seen as being very much the cheaper option. And worst of all, of course, was the feared workhouses, also immortalised by Charles Dickens, of course, in Oliver Twist, which is what we tend to think of today. Before 1834, they were known as poorhouses, and then following a parliamentary act, they were merged together, so there was one workhouse per parish, and the local parish would pay for this. The pauper nurses, as they were called, who worked inside the workhouses, had a particularly bad reputation, as did the workhouse inmates, for drink. And they were basically accused as being drunk the entire time. I think this is something that most of us would have some sympathy with, because it must have been absolutely horrific in there, deliberately so. And I think it's worth remembering that with the workhouses, they were made deliberately worse than the poorest farm labourer on the outside, because basically if you make it worse inside than on the outside, then really only the truly desperate would opt to go in, and this would discourage people from being a drain on the parish. And this is something that's particularly topical in Britain at the moment, and the current government very much has this attitude about the deserving poor and the undeserving poor, which is very, very Victorian in its history. In 1897, the British Medical Journal said, "Charles Dickens's graphic portraiture of the nurse of 1844 gave that rude awakening to the national self-respect which was required to arouse it to action, but it needed a sharper shock before the lethargy of the public conscience was completely overcome." And that shock, of course, was the appalling conditions in Scutari Barracks Hospital, where the British Army was cared for, or not, during the Crimean War, which was in the early 1850s, and where Nightingale famously went out to nurse. Really, it's a lecture or a series of lectures in its own right, the Nightingale's work in Scutari and afterwards her work on health reform. It's not the scope of this lecture, but please, if you've got any questions about that, do feel free to ask me afterwards, because I'm always happy to chat on about Nightingale. Now, the reforms that were carried out, the nursing reforms that were carried out after the war, were largely due to the Nightingale Fund. And we have a poster of this on the screen at the moment. And this was set up in 1855 when people began to realise that Nightingale would not welcome a personal tribute to all of her hard work. Nightingale by this time was absolutely adored. She was a national celebrity. We have at the museum paper bags with her face on pillowcases, songs, poems, really awful poems actually, some of them. You know, she was you know, this massive celebrity. But this was something that she shied away from herself, and she really had this dislike of fame. So it became known that, you know, she wouldn't welcome a personal tribute. And so the Nightingale Fund was set up. And it was specifically set up to have a training school for nurses. It raised £44,000. Nightingale, due to her poor health, would never have been direct head of the school. But she was very, very influential in the decisions and the training that went on there, particularly after the 1870s. It was set up at St Thomas's Hospital, which is where the Nightingale Museum is now. And the Nightingale School remained there, until the Second World War bombing destroyed half of St Thomas's. So the museum now resides in the rather hideously ugly, I'm afraid, white square blocks. So half of St Thomas's is still the lovely Gothic Victorian, and the other half of this post-war modern blocks that no one could actually find their way in because entrances were unfashionable, apparently, and a bit elitist when in the 1950s when it was built. The Nightingale system that was set up at the training school meant that a matron was in complete charge of all of the junior nurses that were under her. And Nightingale herself stated, taking all of the power over the nurses out of the hands of men and put it in the hands of one female trained head. And I think the key word there is trained. And this is very much what Nightingale was pushing for in nursing reform. It's of adequate and active recruitment and of training. And we can see in the recruitment that the emphasis was as much on the nurse's character. Are they reliable? Are they trustworthy? Are they honest? As it was on their experience or their ambition. Now, the nursing record towards the end of the 19th century stated that the character of Sarah Gamp was sufficient to stamp the nurse as a person who disgraced one of the noblest callings to which womankind can devote themselves. Now, I think it's really tempting for us to actually see this reform as something that was quite quick and was quite dramatic, to see the Mrs. Gamps beforehand as being universally bad, and then the reform afterwards as everything was absolutely perfect. As is usually the case, I suspect that the truth is more gradual and also more complex. And I've got a couple of images up on the screen that I want you to have a look at and have a think about. So what we've got is another illustration of Mrs. Gamp, and next to it we have Elizabeth Davies, the Welsh nurse that I've mentioned who took against Nightingale because of her name. And this was taken when she was, this photograph was taken when she was a home nurse, so she'd go into people's homes. And you can see that Mrs. Gamp is clearly looking very shifty. She's looking sideways. She's got her droopy shawl and her droopy bonnet. And there's the bottle of spirits that we mentioned earlier that's up on the mantelpiece. And she's dabbing at her lips because she's just had a swig. And all in all, looks thoroughly untrustworthy and nasty. Next to her, we've got Elizabeth Davies. And actually, she looks very clean. She looks quite respectable. She certainly looks strong. Those of you that have read her autobiography will maybe look at the line of her jaw and think, I can see why she clashed with Nightingale, who is another very, very strong character. But yet, I argue that she's somebody that, in fact, you wouldn't be sorry to have caring for you if you were feeling absolutely appalling and were quite dangerously ill. She looks very strong and very capable. And yet, if you actually look at what they're wearing, their attitudes, their costume is, in fact, quite similar. And it is just a question of emphasis. And I think it's important to remember that the post-nursing reforms had a vested interest in blackening the characters of all of the Mrs. Gamps, the nurses that went before the reforms. Mrs. Gamp as a character leaps off the page at you. So many of Dickens's characters do that. She's a very, very lively and a very believable character. But a colleague of mine at Birkbeck University is actually uncovering some really interesting evidence that suggests that, in fact, there were loads of perfectly respectable and perfectly clean women who were earning a perfectly reasonable existence prior to Nightingale's famous reforms. So it's another example, I think, of how history of nursing is actually unfairly neglected. And there's certainly a lot more work to be done, which is quite exciting for historians. arguably the true descendants of the travelling home nurse actually aren't the later hospital nurses, but are perhaps the local woman who lived in the village, who would give advice of healing or acted as a sort of informal midwife, who was really a mainstay of British culture up until well into the 20th century. Now, to return to the role of the personality museum. These museums form a distinct subset within museums, and they are often but not always linked with a historic house, or in the case of the Nightingale Museum that we have on screen at the moment, with a site of historic resonance for this actual person. Personality museums have a lot of overlaps with university museums or with historic houses for this reason. And they're dedicated to telling the story of the life and work of a famous individual. There isn't a very clear definition as to what makes a personality museum, but I think it's the combination of the personal with the examination of the person's life's work through the memorabilia that's saved. And I think it's the combination of the two things. And I think these museums are of particular relevance in the field of medical history, because medical history has a really strong tradition of celebrating its pioneers in medical history and memorialising them. Personality museums benefit from having a very easily recognisable brand, and this is often a name that they have a name that people will know, that often dates right back to their childhood. So in this way, the Florence Nightingale Museum actually has a much broader appeal than a museum of the history of nursing, for example. People have an idea of what to expect when they come to a personality museum. They know that they're going to have some personal material, they're going to be examining someone's life story, and they'll be examining the significant contributions that that person has made in their field. The visitors will often have some knowledge before they come, and they'll come along quite happy to have this knowledge challenged or to have it reinforced, but they'll actually be prepared in that in some way. And at the museum, what we do like to do as a starting point is to actually use Nightingale's life as a focus. And actually, and this is, I think, my particular attraction to personality museums, it's taking that life and actually using them as a starting point, and thus gaining a greater understanding in the age and the area in which they operated. And this, of course, can be taken much further if we use Nightingale's preoccupations as a stepping-off point to examine issues that are relevant in medicine today. So not using her life as a template, I don't mean that, but using her life and her interests as a springboard, as a sort of stepping-off point that might actually take us in some quite unexpected directions. Oh, this is the interior of the Florence Nightingale Museum in the first section. So in this way, personality museums have got a dual purpose. They act as raising public awareness of that person and their work, but they also act as a sort of localised point for relevant groups, either professional groups or disciplinary groups, or linking in with academia. And, of course, this means that the museum is left with the responsibility of managing all of these different relationships, which, of course, can bring their own challenges. So in the case of the Nightingale Museum, I feel that it's essential that the museum should be seen as a central point for the history of nursing, but also to be seen as contributing to recruiting and training of current healthcare professionals. This is my curator, Natalie, who I've got on screen at the moment, and she's just installing our current exhibition that's on workhouses. So she's there scurrying away, polishing bits of glass just before we open. Now, ensuring that the Nightingale Museum is the centre of the history of nursing is very largely a case of relationship building. And it can be as simple as chatting to people. It might mean that we can lend images from the collection or even introduce people. As I say that the museum should be like the centre of an egg timer, that sooner or later everybody will pass through. And this, of course, puts me and my team at a really key place that we can say, oh, did you know that so-and-so at Case Western University was working on this? And can connect people together. And this is a really important part of what we do. And I think this all contributes to putting the museum at the heart of active research. The museum can make an active contribution to academic research by offering a display space so that people can disseminate their research. There's huge pressure on British academics, and I gather that it's similar in the States, that people have to disseminate their research. There has to be a public engagement element. And, of course, we have a display area. I can cost up an exhibition for you. I can market it. And we end up with a really interesting exhibition to offer our visitors. So, basically, it's a win-win situation. But, again, it's all about managing these relationships. This is Nightingale when she's older, surrounded by student nurses at her brother-in-law's house, Claydon, and he's standing slightly behind her there. And I thought it was a lovely image because it's one I look at quite a lot, actually, because I think it shows her at the centre, and perhaps something that does really interest me, the reflection of her fame sort of being cast out to those around her who are otherwise unknown. And I'll come back to that point in a minute. Contributing to the recruitment and training of student nurses is very much a key way that the museum can remain embedded in the professional community. And we work with student nurses about how nursing has developed, and this can really sort of add to them making an informed decision about the work that they do today. It's really essential that we work in partnership with the training colleges. We work particularly with King's College London and London South Bank. But we work together with them. The students come on inductions as part of their Freshers Week to the museum. We have various sort of nursing skills, clinical skills sessions in the museums that overlaps with public engagement and the nursing training. And we also work with the summer schools, like improving the students' skills before they start. We also have retired nurses who act as volunteers within the museum, and this is a really important part of our visitor experience. So officially, what they're doing is managing one of the activities, which is a very, very simple activity. I imagine you've come across it. It's when you put clean hands underneath the UV light and you can see where all the germs are lit up. Then you put on the alcohol wipe. Everyone's nodding in the audience, and you put it on and there's no germs. So basically, they're very popular with children in particular. And so officially, this is what our volunteers are doing. But of course, unofficially, what they're doing is actually chatting to the visitors. And they're often sharing their long experience of nursing, and particularly of the British Health Service, which is really useful to our visitors who come from overseas. And it really does give an added dimension to their visit. Now, maintaining all of these relationships and still, of course, having a fairly balanced historical perspective can be particularly challenging when controversial issues arise. And we found this at the Florence Nightingale Museum this last year with an ongoing debate over a proposed statue at St Thomas's Hospital to Mary Seacole. Now, Mary Seacole is an absolutely fascinating woman, and she was extremely famous in her own lifetime. Since her death, became virtually unknown, and only in recent years has she become better known, and she's beginning to be taught in schools, and she's a really interesting and important part of black history. Seacole also went to help the soldiers in the Crimean War, and she set up what she called the British Hotel and sold sort of food and treats to the officers. She was a very warm and caring person. Fascinatingly, she called herself a doctoress, and she was amazingly clever with herbal remedies that she'd learned from her mother. Her mother was a Jamaican, and Seacole's father was Scottish. And in her mother's family, there was a strong tradition of healing, and she'd learnt a lot of these herbal remedies from her mother. So she's a really, really interesting character. But there are admirers of Florence Nightingale who feel extremely strongly that erecting a statue to Mary Seacole at St Thomas's Hospital, Nightingale's own hospital, is to denigrate the memory of Nightingale. St Thomas's Hospital is the site of the original training school, the Nightingale Training School, as we've seen, and of course, as you know, houses the Florence Nightingale Museum today. St Thomas's has no connection at all with Mary Seacole, who, as far as we know, never set foot in a hospital and arguably never actually referred to herself as a nurse. However, many argue that a memorial to Mary Seacole is actually long overdue. And as St Thomas's is very central, we're literally on the river facing Parliament, this is as suitable a location as ever, as any. And unlike Nightingale, because Seacole didn't remain famous, there's very, very little material about her life that, in order to tell the story, which does make things very, very difficult and means that a statue is actually much more of an obvious way to commemorate her, particularly in view of the extreme paucity of statues to women in London. It's 15% of statues in London are women, and they're nearly all royal. So actually having a few more interesting characters in history in statues around London, there's definitely a strong argument for that. And potentially, speaking slightly selfishly here, of course, having a statue to Mary Seacole could even benefit the Nightingale Museum, because it would be bringing people in who would actually have an interest of 19th century women, of women's history, of medical history. So it could actually easily benefit the museum. And of course, the difficulty in telling the story where there's very, very little material surviving is a real challenge that many museums recognise. And as I mentioned earlier, the photograph of Nightingale surrounded by the student nurses, for me, has a real symbolism. Because I do think that it's possible to use somebody's fame to illuminate the lives of their friends and their colleagues around them. Nightingale corresponded vociferously with many student nurses and colleagues and gave her advice. Because she was so famous, all of these letters have been treasured and kept. But this actually helps us learn about the other people as well. And otherwise, they would be completely lost to us. Now, this is actually a bad example for me to use because, in fact, Nightingale and Mary Seacole met once, fleetingly and fairly amicably. But nonetheless, my argument stands, I think, that we can actually use the iconic person's life to illuminate those around them. Despite the lack of artefacts relating to Seacole, we do cover her briefly in the Nightingale Museum with a short film on an interactive, and we also cover the life of Alexis Soyer, who reformed cooking and eating for the army during the Crimean War as well. and we're planning to do more work on World War I nurses as well. So we do cover the lives of other people as well. Now, I mentioned at the beginning this strong emotional attachment that people have for their historical figure. A fierce rivalry has grown up between the supporters of Nightingale and those who are fundraising for the Mary Seacole statue. And we have here an artist's impression of what the statue will look like. It's massive, by the way. It's about 4 metres tall in a cast in cast bronze. And for those of you that know London, it's by the same artist who did the statue to John Betjeman that stands at St Pancras when he's holding onto his hat and his coat's flying out behind him. Funnily enough, this feud that has between the two different groups, and it is fierce, believe me. A quick Google search when you get home will back me up. This has somehow morphed, and I find this fascinating, between an actual feud between Mary Seacole and Florence Nightingale. The amount of times that I get asked, why didn't they get on? Is it true that they punched each other and hit each other with chairs? Is it true that Nightingale was a racist? Is it, you know, and it's this whole myth has grown up, which really I find extraordinary. This perceived rivalry between these two women is very, very clearly an artificial construct. But the strong feelings that come from the people who have such a strong sense of ownership is absolutely undeniable. Now, the Board of Trustees at the Florence Nightingale Museum have made a decision about how to manage this particular situation. Their argument is that the appropriate role for the museum is to promote responsible debate rather than actually taking sides in a sort of partisan fashion. And so the participation in the Nightingale Museum's participation in this furor that surrounds me is to provide a forum for debate. Because we're providing an impartial historical perspective, but we're also providing a neutral forum for people to come together. And this meant that last summer we had a really interesting series of debates when we had scholars of Nightingale, we had the supporters of Mary Seacole coming along and basically were let loose and able to talk about whatever they liked. And it made for really interesting public events, but it also meant that we were actually providing a fairly unique role, I think, in providing this venue and by fostering a dialogue and therefore by helping to shape the public conversation. So to conclude, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, it's perhaps my own personal interest in personality museums preoccupies me with the fame of historic figures and how we can use that fame to shed light on the more hidden areas in history. Nightingale's iconic status remained absolutely constant from the minute she shot to fame during the Crimean War to the present day. And it's incredibly valuable in casting light around the 19th century nurses that were around her. And it really does add to our understanding of this fascinating section in medical history. Equally, as I said earlier, her life provides an important springboard for us to really address many current issues, and by using the historical context to give an important perspective. And in Britain, it's a very, very difficult time for healthcare at the moment, and I think now more than ever, this perspective, this slight distance is needed. One of the most interesting things about working with Florence Nightingale as a subject is her relevance to healthcare professionals today. You don't need to make any stretch at all looking at the issues that preoccupied her, infection control, dignity of the patient, care and compassion of nurses as leaders, as advocates, I mean, they literally all do sort of leap out and poke you in the eye as being, you know, all something that preoccupies all of the nurses that I know today. So at the Nightingale Museum, through our engagement programme, we aim to increase our understanding of our shared history of health, but also by using Nightingale's legacy to challenge healthcare issues that affect all of us today. Thank you very much indeed.